Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cyber Security Recruiter podcast. Today, I'm joined by Selena. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
But cool. It's nice to see you again and nice to hear that you got a bit of a break over Christmas. I was the same. I was actually, and I still am here now, but I was in Dubai on a beach on Christmas Day without a Christmas decoration in sight. So it was amazing, but it didn't feel very Christmassy, you know?
It makes sense. We did the same. We were on a beach in Mallorca, but very much not super Christmassy.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. I've been to Mallorca a few times. Yeah. The thing is with Europe, I think the US is amazing. It's the best place to do business on earth, in my opinion. But the thing about Europe is you've just got so, Mallorca, Spain, Portugal, Italy, you've just got everything so close. The UK, you've got everything so close. So that's the only benefit of Europe, I think.
100%. And getting there from California, I have to say, I would not recommend the flight itineraries.
Yeah.
Absolutely stunning once we were there. So
yeah, I find going from, when I went to California, I find going to California was okay on the time difference, but coming back, so when you on the way there, you must maybe found it hard to adjust back to European time zone on the way back from California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally experienced the same.
Big difference. But yeah, no, Selena, welcome to the show. For those that don't know you, I'm just going to do you a bit of an intro. If I get anything wrong, feel free to shout at me or correct me after, but I'll do my best. But yeah, so Selena Stewart started off in the US Department of Homeland Security as a cybersecurity intern, quality internship there, then progressed onto the Organization of America States, and again did security, aviation, and anti-terrorism internship. Then you spent some time at McKinsey & Company. You were a business analyst there and a specialist, amongst other things. You then also had a product management intern with Palo Alto, she must have been good. And then you were also a product manager intern at Duolingo, and then again at McKinsey & Company as an engagement manager of digital and cyber practices. And then you've progressed very nicely at Nuvic, started off as a lead cyber risk manager, and now you've progressed up to director level, and you are the director of cyber risk management. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. And thank you. Yeah, it's you can tell the one thread that I've pulled basically since those undergrad internships, I think starting, over 10 years ago now, which is crazy. But yeah, the main thread there, frankly, has been just my love of cybersecurity. And you can tell I've taken different flavors with it. So very much started public sector, obviously government, multinational government. Frankly, just found the public sector wasn't what I wanted to do. And so took it into the consulting world, fell in love, honestly, with product and being at smaller companies or product focused companies. So then I did my kind of random walk during my MBA and did my product management internships, obviously at Palo Alto, which again, cybersecurity themed, a fantastic place to work. And then now I'm at Nuvic, which is my first adventure outside of consulting full time, which has been absolutely phenomenal and is basically the best of all worlds, where I get to manage a small team, obviously still get to do a lot of the consulting work with clients, and then really get to just do a lot of additional things that I've loved throughout my career in terms of research, being able to speak at conferences, all of those great things. So it's been a really nice mix of basically all of my previous career moves and taking the bits and pieces I liked and just bringing them to a fantastic startup. So
yeah, cool. So yeah, no, there's loads to unpack there straight away, Selena. So yeah, I'm imagining then if government perhaps wasn't enough for you and wasn't stimulating for you, you've gone from that to, I'm hearing words like consulting, small business. So I'm guessing that kind of high touch point, customer interaction, really seeing the difference with what you're doing.
I definitely do. I think it's an interesting mix for me, because I think I'm certainly someone who thrives off of a certain pace and kind of intensity of work, right? And so obviously at a company like McKinsey, you're just constantly driving forward new thoughts, working on different engagements with clients, obviously trying to push forward knowledge outside of that. And then obviously coming to more of a startup environment, it's a ton of fun, because not only am I getting to do all of those pieces and the pace is still fast, but it's really very much self-driven and entrepreneurial. So I'm getting to do a lot more of the client development pieces, actually building out the business unit, building the service line, and just building a lot of the knowledge from scratch in terms of our blogs and all of that good stuff. So it's been a really fun experience. And to your point, definitely the kind of person who thrives off of that energy and intensity in many ways.
Yeah, I can tell by the way you talk, and it will be good to tap into this, because I think people are starting to talk about it more. But like those consulting or those consultative skills and being communicative and having that skill set is, I think, has always been vital, but perhaps not talked about much enough. I've also got a theory that as AI and automation becomes more prevalent, I think that skill set of being able to be a consultant, I think that's where all the value is going to be. So we're going to have a lot of this AI stuff doing a lot of these repetitive things for us. And then this skill set that we're getting into now and talking about now, I think it's just going to go up in terms of its value.
I totally agree. And frankly, I think that's almost been my superpower a little bit within cyber is just that ability to not just communicate with teams, but obviously at some place like McKinsey and in my current role, very much communicate with executives. And a lot of what I help folks with, my core client base is primarily CISOs, so chief information security officers across all sizes of industry. And it's been really interesting because a lot of those folks, incredibly technically sharp, obviously top of their game, but many of them struggle with even some of the basics of reporting, trying to structure the narrative around what they're doing. And there's so many just subtle unlocks in terms of how they present information or how they visualize it, how they think about telling the story that just makes such a huge difference. And so it's ironic. I feel half the time as a consultant, you're pulled in because your core client knows exactly what they're doing. They need resourcing for it. They need buy-in. And so you're that partner in helping build out the narrative of, okay, how do we get you and your team to actually get the resources you need or actually tell the story you need to tell to get the folks who surely want to support you, but maybe aren't bought in or don't realize why it's so important. Definitely something I do on a near daily basis in many ways.
Good. It'd be nice to see in a hat. You got your communication good. And for anyone struggling out there, any tips? And you mentioned subtle unlocks there. It'd be nice to dive into that more. But it's the same with my job. Deal with a lot of people at C-suite. And I've just found, I don't know if you found this, but I've just found over the years just kind of just keeping things as simplistic as possible, getting to the point really helps. Like when I'm pitching our services now, it's almost shockingly like simple. I sometimes think, am I doing enough? But it's just, there's no fluff. It's, this is what we do. This is how we do it. This is who we work with at the minute. Bang. And people are just like, oh, is that it? But it's like, I think people like that key vibe.
I totally agree. And frankly, that's what I would recommend too, is at McKinsey, we call it being very top down. And there's all sorts of business books that have been written about. I think the pyramid principle is one. There's so many basically about this idea, but it's exactly what you described, right? Where you start with the so what or what the key takeaway is, and then you actually build down from that into whatever level of detail the stakeholders want. But I find it especially helpful for executives, especially if they have no context, no real understanding of cybersecurity, whatever it might be, to essentially provide, like, here's what it is, here's why it matters, and here's what you should go do about it. And then obviously having the backup information or the supporting details, whatever is critical as well. But oftentimes I'll, especially in consulting, you'll prepare 50-page deck, whatever it is. If you stick on the executive summary and you have a great conversation, I still consider that a success, right? Because people are still getting the key messages. So I totally agree.
I've got a pitch deck actually, and I think we do still send them out. I might send you one actually, Selina. You'll have to look for your inbox and have a look. But yeah, I think we do still send them out, but I don't really. I'm the same. If you're flowing and the conversation's flowing, you can almost kill the flow, I think, from going back to the slides. But yeah, it's interesting. How did you find on the communication? If I'm listening now and I'm thinking, yep, she's right. Yeah, I agree. But I am struggling and I know my communication's not on point. I perhaps know it's holding my career growth back. I want to get into a director or a leadership position, but I know I can't because my communication is not on point. Have you got any advice for those folks listening?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that come to mind. I think first and foremost is just give yourself practice. And that sounds so silly and so reductive, but even on my own teams, I coach folks all the time. If you're not getting at bats, you can't practice any of this. And frankly, if you're not getting feedback on your communication or kind of aren't in those conversations, you can't do better. And so what I would recommend to folks is just find ways of getting practice and going right along with that. Be really strategic about the things that you want to practice and don't try to overload yourself, right? When I try to do this, I think about from a top-down perspective, no shame in actually scripting out what you want to say in a meeting as you think about the agenda that you're preparing, or even if it's as simple as a one-on-one with your manager or whatever exposure you do have to leadership, even just scripting out, here's my goal for the meeting, and then how you're going to frame out. So whether it's hey, here's my agenda for the week. Do you agree? One of the things that I typically start with is people, even if you want to just manage your own time more effectively and push back in a micromanaging boss, oftentimes it's really easy if you can just demonstrate you're in control, you have agency over the situation by framing the meeting differently, where it's not, oh, manager, what do you want me to do this week? And instead, if you're like, hey, here's the four priorities I have for the week, here's what I'm going to go do, any disagreement, totally flips the script in a very simple way for folks. And oftentimes managers would be like, oh, great, I don't need to be here. I don't need to be a hands-on. I trust this person. Obviously, you do have to, you know, follow up on the things that you're promising to do and actually commit to doing them and everything else. But oftentimes just flipping the script, consistently doing that and putting yourself in that place of framing out the narrative and driving towards your own goal will just unlock so many different pieces. And you can obviously graduate it from there for someone who's more in a manager position and trying to get executive buy-in. Then it's, here's my budget request, here's how I'm using it, or whatever the things might be. But the same principle is just being top down and thinking about framing work consistently.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for that. Yeah, there's loads there. And I think as well about, you talked about being strategic about what you're focusing on and what you're doing. And I think that's right. I think these days it's almost like there's that much information out there. You can, like, one day you can be learning this and you're doing this and you're signing up for this course and you're doing that. And I see it with people that start in recruitment stuff, like they're trying to do this, they're trying to do that. And they want to start a podcast. And podcasts are great, but they want to start a podcast. Before you know it, like, you're doing everything but doing nothing. So it's like, I think you do have to be strategic about it. And yeah, you mentioned about repetition and reps. I was listening to a podcast the other day and they were talking about the people that are the best in the world at what they do, like whether it's a football player doing the kick again and again, or a singer, like how many times has Adele sang a set fighter, that whatever it is, they've all done these things again and again, and that's how you get good. So the reps definitely count. I love that bit as well about, so basically saying before your manager comes to you, take the initiative, bullet point into four steps, bang. I can see why that goes down well.
Exactly. And you can choose, I think the second part about being strategic is you can choose the channel by which you share information. And I think that's another thing that folks sometimes either overthink or underthink, right? Where if you're doing a regular cadence of meetings, oftentimes, again, really easy to flip the script in a one-to-one meeting or a group meeting. I think sometimes too, people underestimate, for example, I've coached a number of folks on my teams where their one opportunity maybe to speak with the CEO in a given month, in a given quarter, whatever it might be. And they'll spend all this time crafting out a huge deck for pretty small decisions. And so it's a little bit of calibration, and you can't fault anyone who doesn't work with executives for not realizing this. But when you think about, for that executive, this is literally one of 15,000 decisions they're making on that given day, relatively minor, doesn't need to be a huge thing. And so if you can actually almost take a pure like mindset, obviously within respectful bounds and everything else, but just think about, could this be a quick Teams message to that person? Obviously, if you already have that type of relationship, or could this be, hey, CEO, here's, again, very top down, my agenda, have a couple things for you to decision super quickly. I'll give you the one or two sentence overview. Not a big deal. Don't want to make it a bigger deal. And so basically calibrating to how important something will be for your audience as opposed to for you, I think can be really helpful to, again, show them that you understand what their criteria are, how they're thinking about it, and then just, again, not create overwork for yourself or overthinking in some cases.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're definitely right. I think it's so hard. In the early stages, I think it's so hard not to overthink. And I've given this example before, but I'm going to use it again, which is, it's like if you're not used to talking to C-suite, it's going to be a big deal. You're probably maybe talking about it to your husband, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend the night before and getting, whereas when you're in the flow, it's like you probably care less, but it probably is actually advantageous because the situation just flows more. It's like, I can compare it when I first started the podcast, Selena, like when we first started, I honestly could do no work for an hour before. I'd be like pacing it. And then afterwards, I'd be so relieved that I didn't completely mess it up, I'd just go for a walk for an hour after. So long story short, like we're doing a podcast a week and I can't get any work done for one whole like Wednesday afternoon or whatever it was every week. Whereas now it's 5 minutes before I plug in the mic and yeah, right, Selena's coming on, it'll be fine, Brad. And you just, it goes back to those reps. You just, whether it's talking to C-suite, whether it's doing a pod, I know you mentioned public speaking earlier, the more you do all these things, the more it flows. And I suppose like anything, the better you get, but it's hard at first, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. And I don't want to undersell any of this. And frankly, I also don't want to undersell. I've been in some painful conversations where it has gone off the rails, script totally out the window, right? And of course, in a management consulting setting, you're getting texted during the meeting. People are like, oh, please adjust what you're saying in real time. So not to say it's been easy. A lot of this has been learned with crying after meetings, walking to your point, taking a walk and just being like, that was either really good or really bad. And I'm not sure what to do. So I definitely don't want to undersell. A lot of these have been hard learned lessons for me as well. But frankly, sometimes you do have to fail a couple of times to even learn your style, learn how you're comfortable, learn what preparation works, learn all of those pieces. So definitely not to say it's easy, but to your point, practice definitely at least helps. And you also start to realize that ideally, especially if you do have a relationship, if you mess up in one meeting, it's not the end of the world, right? That person will still be your manager. They'll still come back, hopefully, to give you another at bat to practice again. Yeah, for what it's worth, certainly not easy and not an immediately natural process.
Yeah, definitely. And also, you know how you mentioned, oh yeah, not everyone, if you mess it up, it's okay. I think that's so true. Like, whether it's posting on LinkedIn or whether it's, I don't know, doing a pod or sending an email, no one's actually thinking, like when it's you posting, you're like, God, I wonder what they think of that post. Everyone's too busy worrying about their own stuff to probably be anywhere as near as bothered as what we think. So sometimes it is, and I do it myself. Like sometimes I do the posts about overthinking and this, that, and the other. But a lot of the time I am talking to myself because I think especially working in a remote environment on my own, sometimes it is easy to overthink and get things wrong. You do this and I've got something going on at the minute with one of my clients. And I'm like, shall I email her? Or shall I leave it? And it's before you know it, you can just get yourself, and it's no, just get on with something else and get busy and it'll probably be fine.
Exactly. And most of the time I do think, especially even most decisions, obviously there are some decisions that are very high stakes, whatever, depending on who might be in those conversations, right? Like executive to executive, manager to executive, whatever. But typically, for example, to continue this one-on-one with a manager discussion, there's also something to be said. If you do mess it up, it's okay to go back to your manager and be like, hey, I was trying a new style of talking. Obviously, maybe this didn't go as well as I wanted it to, but ask for the feedback, start the conversation. And sometimes that's actually a positive thing too, where you can actually be more proactive with your own development. To your point, hopefully start with something low stakes. And then once you have practice build up.
That thing you mentioned about getting a text in the meeting when it's going wrong, I've had that before, but I don't know how you handled it, but it messed me up even more. It's only happened to me a few times, but it's like, I'm looking down, I'm like, oh God. And before I just completely lose my train of thought, that just completely throws me off. I don't know if it did the same to you at the time, but it really spooked me.
Yeah, it's really funny because at a place like McKinsey, it happens so often, even for positive things where it's like, hey, make sure you answer this question, or hey, make sure you're doing whatever. So basically, I just learned and adapted to it. But this is where I would also say coming back to, and maybe I'm revealing too much about my initial style here, but when I used to literally script out, I would tactically write out paragraphs and everything else. And so if you do something like that for yourself, it's easy to be like, okay, I'm going to treat this as just a natural pause. Hopefully I don't seem too unsettled, flustered, whatever, and then go back to the next bullet point. But, and certainly sometimes I think it's okay as well to be like, I've gotten off track. Where were we? Redirect the conversation. And again, being as top down as you can typically helps with that, because it'll immediately start to go back mentally to what was the last thing I said about the so what, and how do I get us back on track from there. Again, it all flows together once you get some of the practice going.
There's definitely nothing wrong whatsoever with scripting. Definitely not. And like I say, as long as you talked about a natural pause, as long as it doesn't sound like a script, and if you pause in, and that's, I think that's the optimal way to do things and move forward. You mentioned public speaking there, and I think stuff like, if you do push the boundaries and do public speaking, the LinkedIn lives get me, by the way. Like I did a LinkedIn live once with the chap that from a company called Risk360, and the software messed up, and that really, I was sweating, Slayer, and everything. It was horrible. I think if you do push yourself on the public speaking, I think that really, you go back to doing a client meeting and it just seems like an absolute doddle when you've just come off a stage, or even a virtual stage with a few hundred people in there. On the public speaking, was that a big leap? Is there anything you've had to learn to get good at that?
Yeah, it's a great question. Ironically, I'm one of these people who I think it naturally comes to me, so I'm probably the wrong person to ask. I even did competitive speech and debate going back to middle and high school.
Oh, wow.
I have always been a talker. That's something that I enjoy. But to your point, I think for folks who are looking to get into it, even in the cybersecurity community, I'm not sure abroad, but in the US, we have something called B-Sides, which are pretty informal, but really great ways of folks to get involved, present research, even small industry conferences too. Like I've attended a number that are pretty professionally and career focused. Hack RedCon was great this year, for example. And oftentimes those have, even if it's not formal public speaking obligations, just opportunities even in networking to get in front of people, talk about what you do, practice your pitch on your role, what you're interested in. So there's lots of little opportunities where even if folks aren't comfortable, for example, pushing for the LinkedIn Live or submitting to the bigger conferences, whatever it might be, just getting in front of people and practicing whatever it is, those sound bites they want to get good at saying, I think it's pretty easy to get involved and relatively, hopefully not too cost prohibitive for folks, although obviously travel dependent for conferences.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's all really good. B-Sides, I've seen it in South Africa. I've seen loads all around the US. Yeah, so I think they do get around globally. But yeah, no, I just think the benefits are endless as well. I think you starting at a really young age, probably you just obviously thrown yourself in there and done it in a competitive manner. That must have really got you off on the right footing. But yeah, I know from a hiring perspective as well, like it massively helps. Like, just before Christmas, I was working with a company, principal pen tester, and one of the criteria was must have done public speaking or at least got involved with the community in some way, whether that was producing like open source tooling or whatever that might be. But I'm seeing this more like even 3-4 years ago, I don't think I would have got that in a spec from a client. Whereas now it's literally they're going, Tom, if they haven't got public speaking, I don't care if they're a rock star, don't put those people forward. So it's becoming like a real part of the hiring process now as well.
I totally agree. And yeah, if it's a helpful anecdote, even at our company, about half the company, we do a lot of offensive security work. And those folks are 100% the people on the engagements, the pen testers, the red teamers, they're in the client meetings. Obviously, they know the work the best. They know their findings the best. And someone like myself or the MD of the practice start the meetings and kind of frame everything out. But for all of those little details, it's absolutely what's folks 2-3 years out of college, fantastic technical skills, and they're just thrown in and chatting right with the CISO. And so totally agree. It's something definitely I see. And I see that being impactful for them as well, but also impactful for the folks who are on the receiving end because they just get so much rich technical detail, which is fantastic.
Yeah, definitely. I can see from a commercial business perspective, I can just see the benefits are endless. If I'm thinking about if I'm a sales guy or girl pitching the services, if I can send that prospective client a video or showcase them talking at DEF CON or B-Sides or Black, whatever that might be, if I can showcase that, that's going to help sell the service in the first place. If you're trying to articulate risk to an end client or trying to get SQLI fixed or whatever other vulnerabilities you found fixed, if you can explain it properly in a nice way, it's obviously from a business aspect, it's everything. It's huge, isn't it?
Absolutely. And frankly, that's what we're seeing a lot of as well. I think what makes our kind of company and our perspective on offensive testing unique is we basically speak in the language of the business, which is risk. Yeah. And so we try to tie that to everything. And one of the things that I've seen that's really interesting, we do a lot of work in the M&A space. So obviously, as companies are thinking about acquiring other companies, whatever, obviously the technical findings are important. And so understanding what those are, especially if you're planning to acquire and integrate a company into your business. But the second thing that's really interesting is it's not just the vulnerability that has to get solved. You have to think about who on the team is going to be doing it, what resourcing is needed, obviously what's the cost if you have to rip and replace to get rid of a vulnerability. And so it's really interesting because I think a lot of folks don't realize you're actually having a conversation about money and the business really cares about money. And so those conversations immediately escalate, right, where you have CEOs, CFOs, folks who might traditionally not be on a readout from a pen test. And it's really interesting because those folks, frankly, they don't really care necessarily what the details of the vulnerability are, but they do care that it's going to impact their bottom line, impact their team's productivity if they have to dedicate resources. And so being able to not only explain the technical detail if they ask, but frame it in the language of here's what you need to invest and also here's the risk if you do or don't, depending on what the situation is. That's the bread and butter of so many conversations right now. Hugely valuable to be able to speak to it.
Yeah, definitely. And Selena, just listening to you speak there's a lot there that you know that you probably yourself don't even think of anymore. But for the listeners, like you've clearly got a strong commercial awareness in general. For people listening that maybe they are pen testers, hackers, security engineers, whatever it might be. Like, for those listening, do you know what an MA transaction is? Do you know what that involves? Do you know what maybe a private equity company does? Do you understand their business model? Do you understand how they make money? Like, all these things, like having that strong commercial awareness, like you mentioned, how's it going to cut? How much is it going to cost? What's the impact on the business? Unless you understand how these different industries operate and how they make money and how they go about things, if you don't understand, that's going to make everything you just described 5 minutes ago pretty tricky. So I think having that strong commercial awareness is huge. And we're living in the age of the internet. If you haven't got it, as long as you're hungry and you're after it and you're focused, it's okay. You can soon pick these things up. They seem pretty complex at first, and these financial people use a lot of fancy jargons. And there was at one point I was like, whoa, this is crazy. But it takes a bit of time and effort, but you can soon get a strong enough understanding, can't you?
Absolutely. And I will admit, I have a pretty non-traditional background, I would say, for cybersecurity. So as I mentioned, obviously MBA, non-technical undergrad, focus more on kind of the risk side of things. So certainly that obviously has just given me a lot of exposure to the financial pieces and more of the commercial side. But to your point, there's so many, I don't know off the top of my head, but there's so many fantastic YouTubers, so many podcasts. All of this information, even if you want to go to Investopedia or some of these, right, as you're hearing different terms and you think about, okay, what does a financial statement even mean? What does it look like? All of this is imminently Googleable. And so even I'm trying to think of good ways for folks to get into it. Certainly, obviously, if you just Google key terms, finance, M&A, obviously, to your point, what PE firms and VC firms do, all of those pieces. But even if folks are sitting in meetings, just write down a list of terms that you hear folks in the meeting saying that you don't understand. That's a fantastic way just to begin to learn and then start to reinforce it to yourself. Again, just get involved with whether it's podcasts, conferences, whatever you can do, and start to see what you learn, because there's, to your point, so much out there, and you just have to be eager and ready to go find it.
Cool. Thanks, Lena. And you say you have I think having that non-traditional background, though, I think that definitely will have helped you, because I think it coming in and having that awareness where others don't, I'm pretty sure that's why you have progressed the way you have. And if I compare it, like, it's, I like to use this saying, and I didn't invent this saying, but it's observe the masses and do the opposite. And if I talk in the realms of offensive security, if I talk to a pen tester and I say, what you're reading about, they're probably reading about red teaming, and that's great, and this, that, and the other. But if they want to stand out, I think this could be a really good way for folks to stand out and cut through the noise. Yes, go and learn about adversarial simulation and red teaming and hacking web apps and APIs. That's all a given. But if you can mix in some of this stuff we're talking about, I think you can give yourself a real competitive edge in a busy, noisy market, especially at the more junior end, or even at the senior end. I think you can give yourself a real unfair advantage, I think.
I totally agree with that. And frankly, I assist with all of the hiring for all of the roles at our company, and we see that to be true all the time. And I think it was true even when I was looking at product management, when I was looking at consulting, is it's very easy to have the exact same skill set as everyone else if you're going through the exact same, whether it's certifications, undergrad, community college courses, whatever it is that you're doing to get your start in the industry. And the interesting thing for me is the people that I find most interesting and most exciting to both interview and then ultimately typically hire are the people who do have that one or two small pieces that are like, oh, that's really interesting. That kind of tickles me. Tell me more about that. And so whether it's a business background, whether it's even some of our technical folks, they love writing. And so it's, oh, that's great. Do you want to write blogs about some of the cool findings you get? Or folks who are really great at doing capture the flags or whatever it is, right, where they have this extra sparkle or little something to add. I think those are incredibly helpful, because the reality is, right, every program is geared to give you the same basic skills as everyone else, but people want to hire individuals. They want to hire people they want to work with. And in consulting, we always joke about the airport test, right? Which happens frequently in real life as well, where you're stuck, you're waiting for whatever delayed flight you have. Will you sit with this person and maybe grab a beer at whatever the airport bar is and chat for a couple hours? Or do you want to be nowhere near them? And typically you want to be with the people that you'd grab the beer with, whatever, or like a mocktail, right? No pressure. Yeah. Anyway, it's all about that, having that little something extra, and to your point, being able to talk about it in a personable and communicative way. So
it's absolutely huge. I'm thinking of a few. There was someone else that I had on the phone. They didn't use it, wasn't called the airport test, but it was another version of that. It was something like, I think one of it was, would you let them look after your dog or your cat? Then one of them was, would you go for it? There was all these tests that him and his business partner had in their heads to basically decide if they were going to hire someone. It's probably similar to what you guys and girls do at your place. But yeah, no, I think it's huge. I was chatting to one chap recently and he saw someone who was articulating themselves really nicely on Reddit, documenting their growth journey. And this company never hires juniors. They normally get people that are a bit more plug and play and ready to go. But they hired a junior off the back of this person just putting themselves out there on Reddit and articulating themselves really nicely in a written format. And it kind of ties in with what you're saying about that kind of likability factor, personality. It all just makes such a huge difference.
I totally agree. And I think that's a secondary thing. And I don't know if this is true for every company. I would hope that it is. But obviously, especially the larger the company, probably the more bureaucracy in the HR practices. But I would also say for most folks, shoot your shot. Like even if you don't have exactly the right criteria for whatever the job posting is, I do a lot of DEI work. And so we always see for especially women, other diverse candidates, right? Oh, we don't exactly match. So we're going to not apply. Obviously, there's a lot of structural reasons why that can be challenging as well. But I would recommend to anyone, you probably are more qualified than you think. And having also gone through hiring recently, there's so many, even out of hundreds of applications, probably less than half were even qualified. And so if you think you're remotely in that bucket, absolutely apply. And the folks who frankly aren't qualified aren't even doing this decision criteria. They're just spamming applications for everything. And I definitely would encourage anyone that frankly, especially if you do, even the fact that person in that example, right, they're showing the commitment to demonstrating what their process is, how they're growing, all of those pieces, that to me is so much more important than hiring someone sometimes that's plug and play who maybe isn't looking to advance themselves, isn't looking to do anything dedicated or with any kind of commitment. So anyway, long story short, those types of skills where you're demonstrating something that's valuable in the workplace, even if it isn't exactly the job description, can be incredibly useful and incredibly relevant for hiring.
Yeah, no, cool. Thanks, Ida. You're right. If people are looking at whether, because that thing they said, so many people are just literally spamming, because that's what I hate about the job ads, where people just blatant, because we don't do any advertising, because like years ago, I just got really annoyed with it. I was like, we've got a good network anyway. We're paying not so much the money for the adverts, but the time that the team would spend to go through all these irrelevant adverts. And then someone sold me a LinkedIn advert, told me they were great. And a librarian applied for a network security engineer role. And that was me. I was like, I'm done now. And that's what's annoying when people are just completely and utterly spamming. It's just, if only 50% of your applicants were spam, I think you did pretty well there, by the way, because sometimes it's about 90.
Yeah, that's very fair. And it's interesting too, because once you start, we typically do a phone screen first before we do full interviews. And it was really interesting because we even had folks who seemed incredibly qualified, would have been fantastic hires if they were who they said they were on their resume. But we would have people where it's clear they just put their resume through ChatGPT, they're reading a script, they can't answer a single question about their own resume or their experience outside of it. So just bizarre. By the time you filter through those people, it's two or three people, maybe one of them's out of your price range, maybe one of them's not perfect, but they seem like they are coachable and that's enough. It's whatever those trade-offs are. And I'm sure every hiring team, again, is different. But yeah, again, I can't fault anyone for trying, but at the same time, if you're holding yourself back because you think you're not qualified, you probably are more so than you would think.
You probably are compared to some of us. It's interesting what you say about ChatGPT as well, because I had another call recently and this person, because this particular person was always adamant they would never ever pay recruitment fees. And then the story came out that, and ChatGPT came up, 30 resumes all looked phenomenal. This business owner had interviewed all 30. All completely out of scope, all put their resumes through ChatGPT. So it's interesting that you're hearing that, because I'm hearing that more and more. Like on paper, people can look phenomenal these days. And I wonder if that's going to get worse as AI gets better. It'd be interesting to, I think that the value of a good screening call first probably going to go up and up, I think.
I totally agree. Yeah. And it's an interesting, even in my own, obviously I've applied to jobs throughout my career. And it's really interesting because it's sometimes a little bit of a catch-22 where especially for large companies, obviously they can't have eyes on every single resume. So they're using applicant tracking systems. And you have to get your resume good enough to filter through those screeners, the keywords. I've heard all sorts of ways that people are gamifying that with AI, creative strategies there. But at the same time, again, like the more authentic that you can be, even as you are embedding submitting those pieces or making sure that your resume will pass through the AI screening, I think the better. I talk about AI, I counsel folks on AI. Obviously, AI is really interesting, but it's also somewhat scary. But I definitely think people are starting to lose a little bit of the human. And I think companies still want to hire humans. And so making sure you're hitting the right balance between obviously giving yourself the right setup, but to your point, not just completely fabricating something using AI, I think is critical.
I think you're right. It's hard to do a podcast and not talk about AI now, because it is just I'm thinking about it every day, and I'm thinking of different, how can we implement it into the business? We were talking this morning about actually deploying the services of an AI agency to come and do a full audit on our business to find out what we're missing out on, basically how we could be using it more effectively to do more with less. So yeah, it's fascinating. It's scary. I think from a security perspective, it's going to make everyone busier, isn't it? Surely.
I definitely think so.
I think it is. It's just, I see as Donald Trump just signed off for 500, was it 500 billion? Was it
500 billion,
I think so. Seems like the US are firmly on board with AI. It'll be an interesting few years, definitely.
I totally agree. Yeah, it's really interesting, because I think we're seeing a lot of companies preparing for AI, but I think we're also seeing a lot of companies almost scrambling to figure out how quickly they should adopt, obviously what the risks are. And I was even doing a tabletop exercise for a client earlier in the week, and it was really interesting because we use deepfakes, obviously, as part of the artifact, since obviously that's becoming a more prevalent way of social engineering, spear phishing, all of those good things. It was really interesting because we were talking about it from a risk perspective during the debrief afterwards, and we came to this point where we were like, oh, but can we, for example, have the CEO just give a video to the entire company saying, hey, we've had whatever this incident was, obviously realized that deepfakes were part of it. And then we got in this cycle of, but how do we know that video is not a deepfake? And how do we, you know, future proof our kind of methods? And so it's really interesting. We almost ended up with an analog, actually physically do a town hall with the company, the employees in the office and whatever, to prove that it's a physical person giving the updates. Obviously extreme example in that case, and requires folks to be in an office, but it's raising these really interesting questions about what's the line between innovation and risk, and what's the line between being prepared and possibly being open to misinformation or disinformation. And I think it's going to be a really interesting space to explore going forward.
But when you think about it, right? So like we're saying now, can we spot a deep fake? Like I recruit in a security space, you're a security professional, and we're talking about how it can potentially catch us out if we're not on our guard. Like when you think about it, what chance is like a normal everyday person that's not even really thinking about cybersecurity? Got one of my friends got hacked recently, and I was like, you know what? I was like, how's that happened? And he got one of those text messages saying that the parcel that it delivered, and he clicked the link and he put his bank details in. And I was like, Steve, man, what? And that seems crazy to me and you, but when you're not in the field, or you're not talking about it all the time or thinking about it every day, that's what folks do. So yeah, when you think about that and the fact we're thinking about it and it could still catch us out, it could be the Wild West for a few years, couldn't it?
It definitely could. I had to exchange some money, and I called my bank. And of course, I won't say the phrase that they use to avoid someone being able to clone my voice, but they use a voice authentication method. And it was fascinating because I was like, my voices, I'm on this podcast, I've been on other podcasts, I have all sorts of videos on YouTube. And again, not going to hopefully say words that someone can use to clone me, but people think about that as, oh, AI is now a great method of two-factor. That's an innovation. But it's actually risky for folks like us, or for folks maybe who have certain words in their voicemail message, or again, any publicly available content. So it's, to your point, very Wild West. And it's a little bit, again, catch 20. What do you do about that?
It's going to be interesting. And when you were talking about hiring, you were talking about taking on people that want to progress. If someone's more senior, maybe they're a bit stagnated, and that's maybe not as it's more appealing to you to want someone that's hungry and wants to progress. And for everyone listening, like, I can really relate to that. If you're listening and you're hungry and you're after it, I think the more you can get that across to employers, the better. Like, we've got a model where we take on less people with less experience, and it is really hard at first, and working longer hours, starting early, finishing late to make sure people are okay. When people get, like, the team now is in a real state of flow, and like last year there was some tough training times, but now it's just like that, and it is so rewarding, like when you see them just do it. So for people, it was nice to hear you say that's what you like as well, because I think maybe people listening might not realize how much an employer or a director or a manager likes that, because it is. I can't wait now to recruit someone else and do it all again. Like at the time, I was like, this is so stressful. But now I just want to do it again. It was so much fun.
I totally agree. Yeah. And I think the secondary thing too is obviously it is role dependent, right? So being driven and being hungry can look very different depending on where you are in your career. And I think even for some of the more senior folks that we've hired or that I've been in the recruiting process for, I think it's also totally fine to be like, hey, I'm really hungry. I'm going to show up 110% to work every single day. But also, I'm at a place where I'm not gunning for the next promotion. I'm really happy with whatever my role is. I want the opportunity, especially for folks in the offensive security side. Maybe they want to tinker with certain things. Maybe they want to go really deep in a certain technical area. And I think those are also ways of demonstrating that hunger and still showing that you're going to show up and contribute without necessarily, to your point, needing to put in, you know, the 12-hour day that somebody more junior might need to do, or doing all of the initial professional development that somebody really junior might need to do. Certainly don't want that to scare off folks who maybe are at a place where they're like, no, I'm actually content with my career, but I do want to change roles. I think there's still a lot of opportunity to demonstrate that same quality, but within different kind of confines of what they're looking for.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Thanks, Lena. On the career progression front, I know we were talking about it just before you came on, but like you've had some like quality, like even looking back to your early career, like internship at the US Department of Homeland Security, that's mega. The time at McKinsey as well. Also the intern related experience with Palo Alto. Have you got any tip? Like how do you land them? Like how do you get your foot through the door? How did you get those postings?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think there's two things. So actually, really ironically, for the Department of Homeland Security, this is a great example going back to a number of things we've talked about, where I actually was somewhat unqualified for it. I was actually younger than they were looking for the initial cohort. And there were a couple of other pieces where I didn't live in DC, for example, at the time, whatever it was. And so they took a chance on me. And frankly, it worked out in my favor, which was phenomenal. But the single funniest piece about that related to our conversation is I did the interview, obviously everything went well. And my hiring manager later, once I had started, she was like, we almost thought like you were too relaxed. You were so comfortable. You were able to meet the date when you were looking for, like the fact that you were young didn't seem to intimidate you. And so it's a great example where I applied despite potentially being underqualified, and then also just was able to present myself and communicate in a way that resonated with folks who obviously much older and more senior. So interesting there. And then I also can't dismiss obviously networking and the value of that. So when I was at the firm, made a ton of connections at Palo Alto, since obviously we have or McKinsey rather has a large presence out here in the Bay Area. And then frankly, I had just maintained a lot of those connections. And so as I was starting to think about whether I wanted to return to consulting, pivot to product management full-time, basically just started leveraging my network. And so Palo Alto was the perfect place for me between obviously working, getting a new skill set from product management, but they work with McKinsey frequently and obviously know McKinsey really well and knew the skills I'd be bringing to product management. And then frankly, just I was able to meet somebody on the team via mutual connection. And again, networking is huge in many ways for that. Certainly don't want to downplay that piece, because in cyber, ironically, it's a huge industry, but it is also a very small industry in many ways.
I can say that. A candidate basically texted me on Boxing Day, having some problems, wanted to move on. And anyway, the crazy week back, that first week that I told you about before we hit record. And so couldn't ring him then, rang him at the end of that week. And then he was like, oh, no, I'm sorted now, Tom. I've got a job with two guys. And he told me who they were. And I was like, oh, yeah, I know Greg. It's like they'd literally been on my podcast about 3 weeks later. So the security community is so small. And yeah, that networking piece, I'm glad you said that, because I was thinking it can't just be that you just had a go. Like there must be something else you should do it.
Yeah, I feel it's one of those where it would be disingenuous not to acknowledge the fact that I have had many privileges to work in the space consistently, to meet a lot of folks, to be invited to speak at conferences, right? Like I've been very fortunate, and I can't downplay that. And frankly, that's why I am passionate about doing conversations like this, because I want to pay it forward. And I certainly would not be here without folks who, for example, had taken a chance on me. And even from the product management example, I had no demonstrated product management skills. It was a total pivot for me. But again, people trust other folks in their network they believe in. And again, if you have transferable skills, I think, and a willingness to learn, I think that goes a long way.
Yeah, definitely. No, I don't think you've been lucky. I think you've networked, and you've networked over a long time, and you've stayed in the same space for a long time as well, which I think is massive. If I look just off your LinkedIn profile, like, you've been in the security space for 11 years. And if you've networked, put yourself out there, spoke at conferences, maintained connections, kept in touch with people, followed up when you said you were, you know, just following up with people, following through, like, the amount of people that you hear from once and then they don't follow up, or they're just not quite on it enough, like, all that stuff, like, it's, you do that over a long period of time, and I think the compound effect of that is a really successful career. And it's like that, we have a saying in recruitment, your network is your net worth, and it's so true. If, as a recruiter, if you've got a strong network, you will never ever, you'll never ever do badly. You'll never ever have a badly performing recruitment agency. A bit like yourself, Slim, like, you've got a strong network. If you ever need to pull some strings there, pull some favors, I'm sure you would be able to pretty quickly. It's, once you've got that network, it's pretty valuable, isn't it?
I totally agree. And I would say nothing frustrates me faster, and I'm sure you've experienced this too, than someone committing to doing something and then totally ghosting you, not showing up, not following through on whatever they would say. And I think that applies for hiring too. Even, it's a little bit funny because I know people always joke, do you need to send the thank you email? Do you need to follow up? And certainly it doesn't have to be anything fancy, but I think just if you had a great conversation, send somebody a note and say, we had a great conversation, and things like that, where it's just showing again that you're actively participating and not just waiting for something to fall in your lap. Or God forbid, the worst thing for me sometimes is having someone in my network who maybe I peripherally know, have been somewhat impressed with, make a connection, and then that person just doesn't show up, doesn't follow through, isn't impressive. And then suddenly you, as the person making the connection, are in a tough spot, right? Where you use some of your social capital and probably you shouldn't have on someone. Definitely goes both ways.
It does. Listen, I can relate to that as a recruiter, because a lot of the time we get it right, but sometimes stuff happens that's out of your control, and you're there. And even if the client's like, look, Tom, it's not your fault, you're like, oh, for God, I don't know what the word, but it's, yeah, you're just like, oh no, why did you do that?
Exactly.
Which is, yeah, it's not ideal. But yeah, I think as well, like, these things that take, like, people do need to see you around and follow through, because I think a lot of people are, I think especially in security, there are unfortunately people that come in, hear about maybe a high salary or this, that and the other, and they're just here today and gone tomorrow. So I think people do need to see that you're sticking around, see you're consistent, see you're showing up, see you're going to say what you're going to do. When people see that, I can relate this back to recruiting in the same space for a long time. I don't want to say it gets easier, but it certainly gets easier when people know that you're really here to stay. They're okay, this girl's serious. They're like, they're sticking around. It matters. And I think sometimes online and stuff like that, everything can look really instant. But again, I'll go back to yours. You've been in security for 10 years. It makes a difference, doesn't it?
I totally agree.
Yeah, no, it does. Cool. All right, Selena. So the hour's really gone quick with you.
Yeah, that's
why. Yeah, it's been really good. Yeah, there's been loads that you've done there. I love how on it you are with the speaking and the communication and stuff like that. It's really nice to hear. I love the bit as well about just incorporating this slightly unorthodox stuff that's giving you an edge or an unfair advantage or whatever you want to call it. I think it's I think it's great. And I think employers and business owners, I can see why that really appeals to them, and I can see why you've progressed quick. One question I always like to ask as we come to the end is, I used to ask about a book, but it can be book or pod or can be online content you're consuming, but it doesn't have to be security related. It could be something that's made you a better version of yourself or helped your career growth. But what book or pod or content have you consumed that's helped you the most, that could help the listeners?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's funny, I did actually do some brainstorming on that one when I got the pre-work for the pod. So I do technically have a canned answer for this. So the two that came to mind for me, and frankly, I have to admit, I'm not a huge self-help person. I very much value almost like the human mentorship aspects, and certainly happy to talk about that later at a future point. But I think there's two. One, and we didn't really talk about this, but I do think it's relevant for anyone who's either woman identifying or also possibly one of the fewer diverse folks in the industry. One is How Successful Women Lead, which I just found to be a really interesting book about how leadership doesn't have to look the same. And I definitely think for me, oftentimes I'm the only woman in the room. And so I've had to adjust my style and learn my style. So that's been a great book that kind of empowered me to think about what that meant critically. And the second one is called Just You Are Badass, which is a fun, I remember reading it on the beach, like very easy beach read, but reminding yourself to take a step back. You don't have to be the world's premier LinkedIn expert on X, Y, and Z. You can be authentically yourself and a badass in whatever capacity you want to be. And I think for me, those are probably the two that resonated the most outside of, again, just finding those human connections to build you up and be sounding boards and thought partners.
Yeah, thanks, Lena. And I'm hearing that more and more as well about you don't, what's that second one called? You don't need to be a badass. Is that what it's called? You don't need to be a badass.
You are a badass, but you don't need to be a badass either. Yeah.
If I was walking down the beach and I saw you reading that, I'd be like, whoa, look at that. that's cool. They sound like, they sound like good. I'm hearing that a lot about you don't need to, I suppose, like necessarily boil the ocean. There's like a room for someone to do really well within a micro niche or a micro niche and just do well within your group of people and stuff like that. So I'm hearing that more and more. But yeah, no, thanks for that. And we'll get them in the show notes so people can tap into them. But yeah, no, Selena, it's been good. It's been nice chatting. And you mentioned there about looking at that last answer because it was in the pre-show thing. But I haven't looked down at my questions once. I've just chatted to you. And they're the best shows, by the way. So it's been good.
No, that's great. No, and frankly, again, as I mentioned with the script, love to be prepared, have a couple bullet notes for worst case if things went off the rails. Here's what we can talk about. Yes, I live my own wisdom.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's just nice to have something there from a script, if it's a podcast or if it's a client meeting. I think just having something there, it's almost like a mindset and it's kind of like having a set of stabilizers, even if you don't need them. It just makes you feel a bit more comfortable before you go on stage or get on the pod or get on that client meeting. So I think it is nice to have that. It helps.
Definitely.
Yeah. Cool. All right, Snip. I know you're a busy woman. So thank you. Thanks for your time. It was nice to see you. And we'll say bye to the listeners.
Awesome. Thank you.